Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find the new season of Here Be Monsters on August 17th at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very happy to have as my guest Tom McCarthy. And his novel, Satin Island, came out last year in paperback this year. It's a very unusual book. It's a very interesting book. The cover, I think, does it all when it says that the book is a novel, having crossed out a treatise, an essay, a report, a confession, a manifesto, and in its blend of these possibilities, it seems to be very much the kind of thing that you do with the International Necronautical Society, the INS. Can you tell me what that is?
It's a hybrid, like the novel, I guess. I mean, I'm very interested in bureaucracy. I love Kafka, basically. Burroughs, Pynchon, Conrad, all these writers who are obsessed with bureaucratic structures and the aesthetics of bureaucracy. And I'm also really interested in the avant-garde, like the historical avant-garde, the futurists and dadaists and surrealists, all the way through to the situationists. And one of the things that fascinates me about them is the way they would use these bureaucratic, kind of Soviet-style structures, kind of Stalinist structures of having a first committee, a second subcommittee, expulsions, manifestos, denunciations. And so the INS is a kind of a play on that. I mean, I created this, I guess you could call it a fiction. I guess it's like a fake organization, but then once you create it and appoint a committee, and you're actually publishing reports, then it exists. It's still a fiction, but it's kind of real. And so I've used this as a structure for collaborating with many philosophers, artists, and doing other projects. At one point, we even hacked the BBC website and used its the source code on some of its pages to kind of set up an illicit message board for a community of artists. So it's, you could say, you know, after Burroughs, it's a kind of experiment in viral media, among other things.
Some of your collaborators, tell me.
Well, Simon Critchley, the philosopher, he's the official philosopher of the INS. He's been a very close collaborator.
And recently a novelist as well.
Recently a novelist, yes, that's right. Stepping on my toes. He better watch his back. You know, the expulsions are never far away. Uh-huh. But, yep, he's been a very central collaborator. Many artists, Alexander Hamilton, the Australian graphic artist, Stuart Home, the kind of novelist come post-punk prankster, you know, Anthony Auerbach as the chief of propaganda and other artists. So it's this kind of fluid network of that can appear and disappear again as the occasion arises.
The narrator of Satin Island, the most recent book by Tom McCarthy and available in paperback from Vintage. The narrator has the initial U, which is one step better than K. You are the narrator of this book, and he has a very original turn of mind. He's a corporate anthropologist, which is to say a kind of apologist for corporate mistakes. And he has the brilliant insight somewhere toward the end of the book that the oil spill that he's been thinking about and looking at videotapes of, that the oil spill can be looked at as an aestheticizing principle, that what it's doing as it lands on the shore and covering the fish is making monuments, works of art, rockifying rocks, making monuments of rocks. So we know, yes, that we have to use declarations with a considerable understanding that he is sincere, but for us, this is irony.
Yeah. I mean, irony is a complex term. You know, it's usually understood as just being kind of tongue-in-cheek cleverness or you know, smarminess. But, I mean, I think the best writers on irony, like the French critic Paul de Man, for example, he understands irony. I think Susan Sontag kind of is in this group as well. They understand irony as a radical split between experience and consciousness of experience, an unbridgeable gap that makes us, you know, in what in French they call a décalage, you know, like a disjuncture, an out of jointness, as Hamlet says. And this is an interesting situation, I think. This is kind of where literature begins, with a troubled, interrupted disconnect between experience and consciousness that makes it impossible to experience anything just as natural or authentic. This is the problem of the literary hero from Cervantes's Don Quixote or Shakespeare's Hamlet onwards, right through all of the modernist heroes. And so this is the type of irony that you, the character, is completely drowning in, like a bird in oil. And of course, there's something perverse in his celebration of the beauty of oil spills.
It's an extraordinary impulse he has, because it's an impulse against the ordinary. Of course, he meets someone who says immediately within the first five pages of the book, it's a tragedy. And his response is, no, you're aestheticizing. By calling it a tragedy, you're bringing it into the realm of art. Yes. Yeah. You see, this kind of irony we're talking about is in fact known as German romantic irony.
Genau. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
It was put forth by Schlegel in his reading of Hamlet. His idea was that Hamlet is not mad. Hamlet is giddy. Hamlet is dizzy. There is no truth or reality that Hamlet can refer to. He keeps spinning round and round, and that's what irony ultimately does.
It's a space of vertigo, which is why my character, you, is obsessed with this parachutist who is just, who's been in the news, whose parachute didn't open, who just falls and falls and falls through endless space.
Now, famously, at a certain point, a whole book was written by Kierkegaard called The Concept of Irony, and he says, I don't believe in irony. It separates us from the world. Irony is too willfully aestheticized. It removes us from the possibility of reality. Okay, here we have a book called Staten Island. It's Staten Island, but in the ironical mode, Staten Island. And in this book, all of the possibilities of truth have been ironized in different manners by theory, by
capitalism,
exactly. And in fact, they are at the corporation at which you work, they're part of a project to change the world. It has a hilarious name. It's called
Koob-Sassen.
The Koob-Sassen Project. I noticed that Koob's book backwards, but beyond that, I couldn't go very far.
I stole a friend's name and kept it, yeah.
But they are trying to embark upon a change so pervasive that no one will be able to say what it is, but the world will wake up one day to find that it is no longer the world it once knew itself to be. Well, this has happened over our last...
Oh, for sure. This is our world.
This is our world. Do you go so far as to suggest that the consequence of totalized irony is an encroachment upon the human?
Oh my goodness, yeah. I mean, the human, I wouldn't even, there is no human without the encroachment. The human is the consequence of an originary encroachment, not just of irony, but of language, of history, of technology. And that's what Heidegger writes about. That's what Marx writes about, Freud. I mean, we are networked, always already. You know, there is no natural, authentic self before the network, before the grid, before the matrix, if you like. And so what you, the character, is trying to do, well, he's a double agent. He's working for both sides. You know, he's been trained in this kind of quite radical avant-garde leftist intellectual tradition, but he's working, and I didn't make this up, more than 50% of anthropology graduates are, for the corporation, deploying this kind of insight to get better purchase on the tribe, who is us consumers, you know. And but at the same time, he realizes this is not, something doesn't sit right here. But he's not just an ironist. I mean, I think he's passionate. You know, he's very aware of being separated through the world, from the world, by a screen, by a veil. I mean, it's a religious book. I'm a total atheist, but it's a theological book. It's about waiting for the veil, whether that is your computer screen or the media or whatever filter you're experiencing the world through, waiting for that veil to be rent asunder and the epiphanic godhead of revelation to come out. So you've mentioned a lot of German thinkers, but perhaps the most important one in this regard is Walter Benjamin, who had this really kind of messianic vision that one day, if we join up the dots, he called it constellation, if we constellate all these points together, then suddenly, you know, meaning will jump out at us, almost like Godhead. And I think my guy is waiting for that, really genuinely. He's waiting for that to happen.
I'm talking to Tom McCarthy about his novel Satin Island. One of his other obsessions, aside from the one with oil spills, is he finds in a weekly-like publication an article about a dead parachutist. He's found dead on the ground. Then he has an even stranger idea, given what we've talked about, that to jump under any circumstance is to take the leap of faith. I thought I'd ask Tom McCarthy to read about the parachutist and his weird leap of faith.
The final spur, the one that carried skydivers across the threshold, out into the abyss, was faith. Faith that it all, the system in its boundless and unquantifiable entirety, worked, that they'd be gathered up and saved. For this man, though, the victim, that system, its whole fabric, had unravelled. That, and not his death, was the catastrophe that had befallen him. We're all going to die. There's nothing so disastrous about that. Nothing in its ineluctability that undermines the structure of our being. But for the faith, the blind, absolute faith, into whose arms he had entrusted his existence, from whose mouth he'd sought a whispered affirmation of its very possibility, for that to suddenly be plucked away, that must have been atrocious. He'd have looked around him, seen the sky and earth, its landmass and horizon, all the vertical and horizontal axes that hold these together, felt acceleration and the atmosphere and all the rest, the fundamental elements in which we hang suspended all the time, whether we've just jumped from an aeroplane or not. And yet, for him, this realm with all its width and depth and volume would have in an instant become emptied of its properties, its values. The vast font at which he prayed and into which he sank as though to re-baptize himself time and again would, in the blink of a dilated eye, have been voided of Godhead, rendered meaningless. Space, even as he plunged into it, through it, would have retreated, recoiled, contracted, pulled back from its frontiers even though these stayed intact, withdrawn to some zero point at which it flips into its negative. Negative world, negative sky, negative everything. That's the territory this man had entered. Did that then mean he'd somehow fallen through into another world, another sky, a richer, fuller, more embracing one? I don't think so.
Tom McCarthy reading a section from Staten Island. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Tom McCarthy about his latest book, Staten Island, the story of one man's directive to prepare a report on our entire era in an era of too much data. You has a girlfriend. Her name is Madison. They fall into sex because they're not very good at conversation. He has asked her why she has been at the airport at Turin. He's asked her over and over and over again. But it gives way, eventually, to the book's one moment of certainty. The woman, Madison, had been in a protest. She'd been with a boyfriend. She wasn't herself a protester, but she'd been surrounded by police who had taken the protesters. It was G7, yes? Taking place in
Genoa, just next to Turin.
She's taken away, where she's faced one-on-one with a torturer whose children seem to be playing in the yard outside. Her narration, as direct as it is very frightening, and it's the place in the book where the reader doesn't get to participate in the distancing that the narrator participates in. We are nowhere close to disregarding her, and she's escaped, essentially, to the airport at Turin, and she's made her way back to civilization with a terrible threat in her life to the question of what is civilization? How does one live after the point where one realizes that one's life is in jeopardy? But she, this woman, seems to be the human voice of the book. Would you agree?
It's a very political book. I mean, all my books are political. All books are political. I mean, you can't separate the political from the aesthetic. But perhaps Satin Island engages with the question of contemporary politics very directly. Firstly, via the fact that you, the character, is basically working for the man and feels uncomfortable about this and has all these fantasies of blowing everything up, corporate sabotage and so on, that he never actually sees through. But secondly, through Madison's experience in Turin. I didn't make any of this up. All this happened. It didn't really make the news because it happened weeks before September the 11th, so no one really gave tuppence about what happened in Turin after the Twin Towers went down. But nonetheless, protesters were rounded up, tortured, beaten by Italian police. And so I did some research on this and I played this out. And I took it further. I mean, what I did make up is Madison's been taken out of the kind of general brutalizing and put in this room face to face with a man who kind of tortures her, but then he doesn't really. They go into this strange choreography and he wants her to kind of reenact certain postures and positions. He seems to be receiving messages from a radio or some old retro kind of transmitter. I was really thinking of, again, of Kafka. The way in Kafka, you know, all his characters are so often trying to get to the room where power is, you know, where the judge will be or the emperor, where they can interface with the source of all power. And they find it's not the room, it's just the waiting room or the corridor next to the room, which is a waiting room to another corridor, to another room. You get the same in David Lynch's films that I was thinking about a lot. You know, you go through the labyrinth, you get to the room and there's a walkie-talkie there or a relay to somewhere else. Power is never here, it's always somewhere else. So she comes to Turin with this almost this kind of old model, A, of what power is, and B, of what political resistance to power would be. She thinks, you know, in this almost 1960s way, you take a placard, you go in the street, you can bring the system crashing down. No, you can't, because the system is networked. It isn't a thing. You know, like in Star Wars, if you drop the bomb down a particular ventilation shaft, you hit the sweet point of the Death Star and you blow it all up. But in this version, there is no center point. There's just an endless, endless network.
In a way, I would say that the novel is about the failure of the aesthetic position. And it has as an epigraph something from Mallarmé that's so useful in this regard that I want you to read it.
Outside, like the cry of space, the traveler perceives the whistle's distress. Probably, he persuades himself, we are going through a tunnel, the epoch, the last long one, snaking under the city to the all-powerful train station of the virginal central palace, like a crown. I mean, that passage comes from Action Restrained, which is Mallarmé's kind of apologia, if you like, for not being basically a bomb-throwing anarchist like most of his friends were. And he's saying, look, my work is political, but there is no present moment that can be grasped. We live in a kind of intermission, an interregnum. For the poet, the present moment is an interregnum. It is not now. Ill-informed the man who would think himself his own contemporary. But then he says, there is an event. Watch out. An event j'ai toujours à nommer. An event I have yet to name or I am forever naming. But I love this idea of interregnum. For me, it's summed up in the British cover of the book just shows a buffering symbol. You know, when you're waiting for the stream to download and it buffers, that little circle spins. For me, I mean, you is obsessed with that as well. For him, that's the icon, almost the religious sacred icon of our era is the buffering sign. This interregnum, this pause, this interval where everything is in suspense. And it's a space of anxiety, but also of possibility.
Back to you and the report he's been assigned to do. Does he make progress at all? Is there such a thing as making progress on such a report?
Well, this is a Mallarmé thing, too. I mean, Mallarmé had this fantasy that he dedicated the last three decades of his life to.
To the book.
The book. Le livre. Which would not just be a book, it would be like
the book.
Book. And everything that exists or that has ever existed is destined to end up as part of that book. So it couldn't even be a book in the conventional sense of like even a million pages of paper. It's got to be some multimedia networked, expanded. I mean, it's incredibly prescient. He's almost describing Google or something. You know, but this idea that everything could be in the book, but of course he never writes it. It remains eternally to come. So what you end up reading is not the book that was meant to be written. It's not the report. It's the kind of offcuts, like the bits that didn't make it into the movie, this detritus, this trash. And I love that, the idea of a novel not as being the perfect work of art, but the kind of refuse of everything else.
Well, I'm going to do it because what it amounts to is that the ineffable is that which is not here.
Mm-hmm.
What is here is the residue, the garbage.
It's the negative. There is somewhere a Platonic photo, which would be the book, the image, and this is the negative of that image, you know.
So Staten Island is a version of Staten Island, and Staten Island is seen as the place which had been shut down in its trash heap phenomenon to receive the garbage.
The overflow.
The overflow from 9/11. So suddenly we're talking ultimately about a culture that has no culture left, only the garbage of the culture. We have to figure out what to do with the garbage because it's all we have.
Yeah, but when you, the character, does some research into Staten Island, he discovers that actually it's not a trash heap anymore. It's a nature park. The trash has been covered over with nature. It's become this this ground for the wild duck and the coot and lovely fields and marshes. And again, this comes back to the oil spill. You know, this underneath the pristine surface of nature, which we can fetishize, is actually violence, history, industrial toxins. I mean, there's a whole... You know, it's like the beginning of, I love the beginning of Lynch's Blue Velvet, where the camera goes down under the lawn and you just see the cockroaches, you know, or whatever they are, the beetles, the beetles, the Ungaziefer, Gregor Samsa things underneath.
I've been talking with Tom McCarthy. We've been examining the kind of philosophy which turns from philosophy to eternal procrastination. It keeps delaying the arrival of conclusions. The book is called Staten Island by my guest, Tom McCarthy. It's published in paperback by Vintage. Thank you for joining me.
It's a great pleasure to be here again.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Staten Island at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Joe McGinnis Jr. is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.